Seekers, Mike Malloy here. Thanks for tuning in. Is Cheney's heart still going? Like a garden hose? I think it is. The Republicans really just have no shame. The Democrats asked for unanimous consent in the Senate, I think it was yesterday, to pass legislation that would give the BP Oil Spill Commission subpoena power. That's all. Just the right to force witnesses to come in under the penalty of the law if they chose to not show up. I'm not sure if subpoena power gives them the right to swear in the witnesses. I know that during the 9/11 commission hearings, there was no subpoena power whatsoever. The Republicans made sure that the American public would never know the truth. The extent to which Bush and Cheney were involved in that bloody day. So now the Republicans are at it again. Well, not again. They always are this way. I don't know why Republicans are allowed to even run for office. They ought to be banned from office, deported, beaten up. The Democrats asked for unanimous consent in the Senate to pass legislation that give the BP Oil Spill Commission subpoena power. And surprise, surprise, guess who stood up for BP and objected? Wingnut, teabagger, freak, right-winger, Jim DeMint of South Carolina. This guy is, he's a one man, and the Republicans love him, and the baggers love him. You baggers, you love this freak, don't you, huh? You love this freak. You love the fact that BP has screwed up the Gulf of Mexico. You slimy Republicans, you. Republicans don't want BP executives or any of the rest of them to have to testify under oath. Law and order Republicans. You people are a bunch of criminals. You really are. And when the day comes to open the fourth box, oh my, oh my. So without subpoena power, the BP Oil Spill Commission is a joke, a hoax, another Republican enterprise. Now, the Democrats are at fault here, too. The Democrats should have listen to what the Republicans said about refusing to give unanimous consent, and then put it together and let the Democrats or the Republicans, there's no difference, threaten to filibuster, whatever the hell they do. But the Democrats, being the cowardly, bedwetting, thumb-sucking, hair-twisting geeks that the Democrats are, you know, that's not the kind of party you need to have up against a bunch of fascist pigs who are determined to take over the United States government completely. They already have. Corporate capitalism already has, I don't know, pick a number, 95% of it. The Republicans don't want to take any chances that their sponsors, their capitalist, filthy, murdering sponsors, in this instance BP, would have to testify under oath. The truth might out. My God. Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, addressing the a Commonwealth Club event in Santa Clara today, went after the pigs, the Koch brothers, these two bastards who are funding through their companies. I think the oil companies are Valero and Tesoro. I don't know if one or both of those or neither is owned by the Koch brothers. But the Koch brothers have contributed $1 million to overturn California's greenhouse gas laws. And Prop 23 is what it is to overturn this. The Schwarzenegger really went after these bastards. He said that overturning this is not about saving jobs, which is how it's being presented, you see. saving jobs. Like capitalist America cares about saving jobs. The Koch brothers care about saving jobs, right? This is pure, simple, filthy Republican greed. That's all it is. Schwarzenegger said, not about saving jobs. It's about greed. Schwarzenegger lashed out at the companies involved here, particularly Valero, Koch Industries, and Tesoro, who are trying to get rid of the state's carbon regulation law. They're pumping millions of dollars into it. The law is known as AB 32. Prop 23 would overturn the law. Now, the way the law is written, or the way the dumbasses in California go to vote, will determine whether or not people get what they're voting to overturn. spending billions and millions of dollars on advertising in California before the vote, though, is what the slime and the filth and the capitalist pigs always do. They've got the money, so they buy the ads, you know, the ads on television that make it appear that unless the voters of California overturn AB 32, the state is going to wind up destitute. No jobs. Oh, my God. They don't have any jobs now. This way, they'll not have any jobs and they won't be able to breathe. Oh, well. Schwarzenegger said, quote, this is a corruption of the democratic process. Texas oil companies have descended upon California to overturn a California law. There is a struggle playing out right here in California that the world does not know much about. Arnold Schwarzenegger. He said the effort is similar to the conspiracy hatched among oil companies in the 1920s in California to get rid of the light rail systems. And then the companies bought up the easements for light rail systems in 45 cities and then systematically dismantled them. Huh? How about this? You go, Arnold, but it might be too late, bro. You know what I'm saying? He went on to say, quote, today, Valero and Tesoro are in a conspiracy. Woo! Not a criminal conspiracy, he says, but a cynical one about self-serving greed. Does anyone, Schwarzenegger asks, think in their black oil company hearts that they want to create jobs? Valero and Tesoro, he went on, want to stop the movement from old energy to new energy because it means lost market share. He then rattled off a number of impressive statistics. California is home to 12,000 green companies. Approximately 40% of the green patents awarded so far are awarded to California inventors. A wind farm in Kern County, California has created 1,000 jobs. Solar thermal will create 2,000 jobs. Green tech jobs have grown 10 times faster than the jobs in other sectors. None of this means anything to these filthy capitalist pig bastards named the Koch brothers. They don't care. Why should they? Arnold Schwarzenegger, my goodness, between him and Mayor Bloomberg and a few other Republicans, what? Where are you guys coming from? Are you really interested in people being able to breathe? Are you really interested in fighting these hideous sons of bitches in these capitalist organizations who care nothing about anything, who destroy stuff because they can? And they get off on it? You guys are really getting serious, you Republicans? You too. Not the rest of the, not the trolls out there, not the booger eaters who, oh, well, yeah, let's vote for Prop 23, because if we don't, I'll lose my job at McDonald's. Nom, 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 nom. Which is how it's being presented. More on this when we come back. God, these people piss me off.
With the truth. It's more Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. So Arnold Schwarzenegger getting pissed off in the way the Terminator, only the Terminator can, is pointing out the disgusting filth that has invaded his state to overturn AB 32, the state's carbon regulation law, with a public initiative called Prop 23 that people will be voting on soon. And as Schwarzenegger points out, the people who are sponsoring Prop 23, they're not, you know, their commercials are talking about jobs. And the poor bastards in California who actually are hurting, desperate for a job, will see these commercials and believe that if they vote against AB 32, in other words, for Prop 23, that somehow, miraculously, these filthy capitalists, the Koch brothers, and these filthy corporations, Valero and Tesoro, I guess those are oil companies, will somehow miraculously create jobs for them, which is not the case. If this law passes, it means the stockholders of these putrid companies that are destroying everything on Earth, including the Earth, the stockholders will desert the company. The stockholders will say, well, it's time to get into some green industries. Let's bail out of the carbon industries. Maybe, maybe not. But filth like the Koch brothers don't want to see the value of their public shares go down 10 cents a share, much less take a big hit. So consequently, they are willing to spend millions, tens of millions of dollars, the Koch brothers and these other capitalist organizations that want to strangle you and your children. They're willing to spend millions of dollars to defeat a proposition or a law that was passed in California by the California legislature to try to do something about the filthy air that California men, women, old people, children, babies have to breathe. But the Koch brothers, being the filthy, greedy pigs that they are doing everything they can to overturn this. Schwarzenegger went on, green jobs are the single largest source of job growth in California. 500,000 green jobs have popped up in California since 2005. He added that the U.S. Navy has also imposed stringent goals for renewable energy, adding that the Navy isn't the usual pot-smoking, left-to-center Berkeley resident, whatever that means. I guess anytime somebody comes out in favor of saving the goddamn planet, anytime somebody comes out in favor of having air we can breathe, water we can drink, dirt we can plant things in, you have to make a distinction that those people are not pot-smoking hippies from Berkeley. Come on, Arnold. That was 50 years ago. He also said that Valero's argument that suspending this this greenhouse gas law, AB 32, will create jobs. That's what the oil company is saying. Schwarzenegger said, that's like Eva Braun writing a kosher cookbook. Is that funny? I'm not sure. Hitler's mistress writing a kosher cookbook. Oh, well, I think we get the point. Despite all the rhetoric about Valero and Tesoro and these filthy, disgusting Koch brothers, Schwarzenegger declined to criticize Meg Whitman, the Republican running for his job. Whitman says she wants to suspend AB 23 for a year. A year. The governor said he's mostly concerned about defeating Prop 23. Neither Whitman nor opponent Jerry Brown will be governor when that vote takes place, Schwarzenegger said. All Schwarzenegger said was that Whitman, who has spent $120 million of her own money on her campaign, he said that Whitman should spend her millions on defeating Prop 23. Schwarzenegger added, quote, California is America's last hope for energy change. We intend to win this battle. Well, good luck, Arnold. The Koch brothers and the filthy, disgusting, carbon-based capitalist pigs who don't want to see their share prices go down a nickel are out to defeat you. When you have pigs like Glenn Beck and filth like the Koch brothers working together to destroy the United States, you would think, wouldn't you, that a band of vigilantes would drag these people into the streets and give them a people's trial with a people's judge and a people's jury and a people's prosecutor and even some people's defense attorneys. And that issuing subpoenas would not be necessary. You would just have people testify about how people like Beck and the Koch brothers are destroying our way of life. And then you would ask the jury for a verdict. And if the verdict came back guilty, then you would ask the people's jury what would be appropriate punishment for people who are trying to kill millions of Americans. I wonder what the answer would be.
Time to practice your synchronized screaming. It's Mike Malloy.
It's 25 before the hour. I get so angry sometimes that I have to go back and correct the factual errors I make when I am screaming into the microphone. Koch Industries is not a publicly held company, so there is no stock price. It is a private energy conglomerate based in Wichita, Kansas. It also owns, in addition to Koch Industries, it also owns Invista, Georgia Pacific, Flint Hill Resources, Koch Pipeline, Koch Petroleum Group, Koch Fertilizer, Koch Engineering, Koch Minerals, and Matador Ranching Company. They are involved. The company is involved. Koch's companies are involved in core industries such as the manufacturing, refining, and distribution of petroleum, chemicals, energy, fiber, intermediates and polymers, minerals, fertilizers, pulp and paper, chemical technology equipment, ranching, finance, commodities trading, and so on and so forth. If Koch Industries were a public company, it would rank about 16th in the Fortune 500. In 2008, Forbes called it the second largest privately held company in the United States after Cargill, whatever, with an annual revenue of about $98 billion. These are the Koch brothers. Now, the other two, Valero Oil, ranks 28th among corporations emitting airborne pollutants in the United States. They The last time anyone counted was in 2005. 3.4 million pounds of crap, toxic crap, into the atmosphere. Tesoro is the 24th largest corporate producer of air pollution, releasing roughly 3.74 million pounds of toxic chemicals annually into the air. Major pollutants that they release include more than 2 million pounds of sulfuric acid. It just goes on and on. These are the people who are trying, or the companies, and, well, not the companies, the people who are trying, who are pumping millions of dollars to try to get Prop 23 passed in California, which would guarantee that people trying to breathe in the state of California would have much more difficulty in doing so. What? California has become a sewer blank hole? Oh, God. This is from William. First, a lot of people got ripped off by PG&E, and the state got pennies back on the dollar for this theft. The ocean looks like a sewer and has the smell of one. Most of the good beaches are long gone and have become private, all fenced off to the public. Jerry Brown is another freak, has been, and Meg Whitman of eBay is just as bad. What a choice, an old freak or an eBay runaway. There are no jobs here. With the heat we had yesterday, 113 degrees, I was sort of hoping in an odd sort of way that the earthquake we've been waiting for would come. These corporate freaks cannot buy air to breathe, so in their willful, ignorant process of killing all the working class heroes, they will kill themselves, and they don't seem to see this fact. And then there's some more with a lot of F-bombs. Thanks, William. I appreciate it. I know you're angry, too. You have to live there, right? Oh, my God. Just, you know, you can be a brain-dead teabagger if you want to. As a matter of fact, some of you really are. Or even worse, a Republican. Teabaggers, you can understand their insanity. They are very twisted individuals. Republicans or conservatives were supposed to have at least part of their anatomy in the real world, and obviously they don't. But the insistence on the part of capitalist America that it is going to destroy this country, it really has done a hell of a job. I mean, you think about it. Capitalism is a system that can't even handle mortgages, can't even handle home mortgages without the whole financial structure of the planet put in jeopardy. Is that what capitalism does? Great. Uh-huh. And the right wingers and the Republicans, you morons who insist on promoting people like Palladino in New York and what's the one in Nevada? What's that crazy broad's name running against Harry Reid? Yeah, she's the Republican nominee. What's her name? I don't care. And then this crazy person that arose out of the nowhere in New Hampshire. I mean, they have one goal, and that is to destroy the country. This has got to become a religious campground. It's got to become like a Latin American colony of Norte Americano. Like around the early 20th century, where people live in abject poverty and work for United Fruit, and the local priests assist the capitalists in keeping the working people in ignorance. Your reward is not to come here, the priests would say. Your reward is to come in heaven. So do what United Fruit says, pick the bananas, and then every time there was an attempt to overthrow this hideous, hideous alignment of the church and capitalism, then, of course, the army would be called out, and the peasants would be mowed down, shot to death, hanged, tortured, beaten, eviscerated, cut into pieces. I just don't quite understand why. Wait a minute, my producer's in here. What is it that you're trying to do? Is there something going on that I should know about?
Just that.
Huh?
Just this.
The never-ending effort, the never-ending determination of the capitalists to destroy the country. That's what I can't seem to make sentences work here. It just freaks me out entirely. And the brain dead Republicans who insist on hanging themselves with the rope provided by these bastards. It makes me crazy. A guy named Chuck Fager, who I talked to on the air one time, he runs the Quaker House in Fayetteville, North Carolina, not far from the massive army base in Fayetteville, North Carolina. And he does a lot of work with veterans. Chuck is a veteran. And he sends me his newsletter, the Quaker House newsletter. Comes out quarterly. And in this issue, he's written something here about the continuing cost of the Iraq War. He talks for a moment about ending our military operation, right? Isn't that, we're pulling out 130,000 of our soldiers and leaving 50,000 behind. The special forces, the Army Times reported that the special forces left there will continue to help Iraqis hunt for terrorists. In other words, warfare. I mean, what the hell do you call that? We call it hide and go seek? But Chuck goes on to talk about the war's actual costs in blood and treasure and how it's going to be a financial and moral burden on this society for decades to come. And he says that's only the beginning. Consider some other costs. Number one, based on lies, the war has corroded public trust in government. From a phony connection to September 11, 2001, to non-existent weapons of mass destruction, to the Pat Tillman scandal in Afghanistan, and on, the lies kept piling up. Number two, the cynicism has only deepened with exposure of some of the largest ripoffs and robberies in recorded history. Literally billions of U.S. tax dollars stolen from Iraq by crooks, foreign and domestic, with very little in the way of recovery or redress. Nor does this include several billion dollars more wasted on unfinished or abandoned boondoggle construction projects. He's got some more here, and I want to share it with you when we come back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Shut up.
up to the flying monkey right. It's Mike Malloy.
It's about 10 before the hour. Yeah, if you were watching on Ustream, we had to log off. And we'll bring it back during the break, the top of the hour. Anyway, Chuck Fager, who heads the, he's a Iraq War veteran, he heads the Quaker House in Fayetteville, North Carolina, near the huge military base there. And in the autumn 2010 issue of the Quaker House newsletter, he's writing about the costs of the Iraq War, starting the Iraq War, and of course, part of it is the war in Afghanistan also. Anyway, he's talking about the cynicism engendered by all the ripoffs that occurred. Capitalist America has real, they love wars because in the confusion they can steal billions. Dick Cheney's companies have stolen billions of dollars. I mean, just walked away with it. Rumsfeld's companies stolen billions of dollars, just walked away from it. This is what happens in war. And he goes on to say the shocking, one of the moral burdens and financial burdens that we're going to have to endure in this country because of Bush's war, the shocking legitimation of torture as U.S. policy, which undermines the rule of law. The war made us less safe. Torture and the war more generally have been the best recruiting tools religious extremists in the Middle East could have ever have wanted, bringing in thousands of recruits, burning for vengeance. Going on, he says, number five, it's feeding an ugly strain of domestic anti-Islamic bigotry. Number six, it's damaged the U.S. military after years of grueling deployments in a war without justification. Record high GI suicide rates are only one symptom of the hell wreaked on the troops and their families. Number seven, expanded official spying and erosion of our civil liberties. Number eight, the ominous rise of private armies in the United States, such as the notorious Blackwater. And what about the cost to Iraq? Yeah, Saddam Hussein was removed. Elections were held, though there is still no functioning government. But what price did the Iraqi people pay for this uninvited mission of liberation? Well, here's a list. 500,000 to 1 million civilians killed. Ongoing sectarian and political violence that kills hundreds more each month. 45 million Iraqis made refugees inside and outside their country. Hideously high rates of birth defects, childhood cancers, and other horrors. Women's rights sharply curtailed by the new ruling groups. The once numerous educated and professional population decimated or driven into exile. The ancient cultural heritage looted, destroyed, or dispersed. Public infrastructure like electricity and water still barely functioning. Unemployment rates in excess of 40%. Venerable Christian and other minority religious groups subjected to murderous persecution or driven from their homes. Chuck writes, I won't try to predict the future, but it would take a lot to make all this destruction even remotely worth the sacrifice of U.S. troops and the greater sacrifices imposed on the Iraqi people. And, of course, Chuck, in addition to running the Quaker House, is a veteran. Running the Quaker House in Fayetteville, North Carolina. But the Republicans will tell you that all of it was justified. It was all justified. A war based on lies, deception, greed, Dick Cheney's filthy, degenerate attitude about the world. He knows he's a dead man walking. He wants more people to die with him, or before him, or after him. George Bush, who didn't have the sense evolution gave, a sack full of snot rags. And then, of course, we have the great savior, Barack Obama, who, take your pick, is either just as venal as these bastards or has been completely flummoxed by the military-industrial establishment that Eisenhower warned against in Obama's attempts to bring this madness to an end. And that last one, like I said, take your pick. You know, whatever you want to believe. But here we are, right? Oh, by the way, keep this in mind, you teabaggers. Not that you care, because you are filth, all of you. But keep this in mind. The children of working class people are dying because of the Reagan-Bush tax cuts. Are you aware of that? Because of the greed that brought those tax cuts into play, because of the determination of the capitalist class to gut the social safety net, to rip it to pieces. Kids are dying because there's no money for Medicaid. There's no money for the children's health insurance program. There's no money for anything. And these greedy sons of bitches, open the New York Times any morning and look at the ads. Look at the ads in the A section, especially on pages 2, 3, and 4. The ads for, excuse me, $1,500 pair of shoes, $3,000 jacket, $10,000 coffee table, $75,000 pinky ring. And then think about kids in Tennessee or Montana or Illinois who are not eligible for any kind of assistance. Their parents can't afford insurance, and these insurance pools have not been formed yet. And not only are the kids not eligible, but even were they eligible, the states don't have any money. So the rolls are frozen. Nobody else can get on. And the ones that are already on are getting reduced services. But I'll tell you what, these pig bastards who brought this about are still able to buy their $15,000 leather boots. Right? Wow.
Is your computer.
About the fact that children die so these sons of bitches can buy their $80,000 wristwatches. It's pretty incredible. Michael Payne has something up at Op-Ed News. He's talking about the feudal system, common in Europe between the 9th and 15th centuries. And he's explaining that system and capitalism are different, except for a few specific similarities. Each system involves a hierarchy that includes lords at the top and serfs at the bottom. The system we call capitalism and the corporate lords who administer it have transformed once valuable and productive manufacturing workers into no more than serfs. It didn't take them long, did it? When was the Industrial Revolution? 1840s? As a little history lesson, this is primarily for you half-witted Republicans. Feudalism was a social, political, and economic system in which the king was the supreme ruler. The lords, sometimes called barons, were appointed by the king to essentially run the system, to carry on commerce, primarily agricultural, generate taxes for the kingdom, and when necessary, provide men to fight in the king's wars. Lords allotted the land, called fiefs, to vassals who utilized peasants and serfs to work the land, grow the crops, and return a portion of the harvest to the lord as payment for rent. Peasants and serfs were much the same, but peasants were cut above as they had more privileges and less onerous duties. Some might say that trying to compare feudalism and capitalism is irrelevant and meaningless because the systems belong to completely different periods in history. But there are some elements in each, are there not, that are worth analyzing. Both feudalism and capitalism depend heavily upon taxes generated by their populations to carry on the functions of government, to maintain infrastructure, to provide social services, and important in both systems, to conduct wars initiated by the rulers. So in those ways, the systems are very similar. Each system utilized labor as its foundation. Feudalism with the serfs, capitalism with the workers. And, Michael writes, that's where the similarity ends. In the feudal system, there was a long, uninterrupted, although dominating relationship between lords and serfs, with the latter, the serfs, having jobs for life, even though their tenure might be dangerous and short. Serfs were largely bound to the land and to their jobs. The lords did not want to lose them. And in fact, took steps to guarantee that they stayed in their employ in that very tightly controlled system of bondage. It's very much like slavery in this country in the 19th century. In today's America, Michael writes, the situation is exactly the opposite, with the lords of corporate America doing everything they can to destroy and end the relationship with American workers. These corporate lords have decided that they want a vastly different system, for they feel no sense of connection or obligation to America's workers, otherwise known as American serfs. In America, our corporate lords have no allegiance to their workers or their serfs. They have learned that they can readily use peasants and serfs in other lands to produce far more crops, quote, quote, at much lower rates with no job benefits. So why should they stay here? Right? This new, Michael writes, very profitable alliance is, of course, commonly referred to as outsourcing jobs to overseas nations, and it's working beautifully, not for American workers who are forced into unemployment, but for the corporate lords who grossly enrich themselves this way. Now, let's discuss how the feudal system ended and how that relates to the continued erosion of our system of capitalism. The Black Death, or bubonic plague, ravaged North Africa, Asia, and Europe beginning in 1349. It spread through many countries and was a large contributing factor in ending the feudal system as it killed many millions of people. This deadly disease greatly weakened the system, causing a deterioration of the land and the crops. As time went by, there was a natural evolutionary process whereby peasants and serfs who no longer had jobs became freed men and gravitated to new types of employment like carpenters or stonemasons or blacksmiths, tanners, and other trades. So, in actuality, the feudal system ended on an upside as the masses of peasants and serfs were freed from their years of bondage and began entirely new lives and occupations. In the long run, This also benefited the nations of Europe as it enabled them to advance their commerce. Right? Pretty cool, huh? The American system of capitalism, however, is headed in the exact opposite direction, downward. This system, American capitalism, was once the envy of the world, but it has steadily eroded, largely because of corporate greed and manipulation designed to produce enormous profits. While not of the scope of the Black Death, this erosion is still a deadly societal disease that has created a vast imbalance between the ultra-rich, including corporate lords, and the rest of us. Primarily the disappearing middle class and the growing poverty-stricken segment of our nation. We might call this disease not the Black Death, the economic death. In our form of capitalism here in the good old U.S. of A., as we all should know by now, it is imperative that the people buy the products and services that fuel our economy and contribute to our GDP. What did the corporate lords think was going to happen to the economy and their profits when they began the process of outsourcing American jobs to overseas nations? What the hell were they thinking? These actions have created a rapidly growing population of worker serfs who previously had decent jobs and pay, but are now being forced to take lower-paying, less-skilled jobs in the service sector. Just the reverse of feudalism and the serfs back in the day. Isn't American capitalism amazing? In America today, when millions upon millions of workers can find no jobs and they become desperate, they also become prime targets for the predatory army recruiters. They often have no other alternative, and so they provide a steady stream of serfs for America's military machine. Cool. The corporate lords, meanwhile, are hard at work stuffing their pockets and enriching their bottom lines, and though they refuse to acknowledge it, their actions and policies are bringing economic death to America and capitalism. The more they outsource, the more workers go on unemployment or take lesser paying jobs, the less purchasing power those workers have, and the less the contributions to the economy and corporate profits. It's a vicious circle that seemingly has no end and which will eventually bring disaster to our obsolete, unworkable, capitalistic system. More in a minute.
Come 50,000 watts of free speech. It's Mike Malloy.
It is 21 past the hour. Going back to this comparative analysis of serfdom in the period of time from about the 5th century to the 15th, and capitalism now is written by Michael Payne. I'm sorry, the 9th and 15th century. Michael Payne writing at Op-Ed News. He goes on, the most respected economists have stated that the healthiest economies in U.S. history have been those where worker employment has been high and where wages have been fair and reasonable because their purchasing power directly benefits the economy. Henry Ford was well aware of this fact And he paid his auto workers very good wages because he knew that many of them would in turn buy his Ford autos. That was one of the keys to his great success. Why can't corporate America now understand these basic tenets of economics? Corporate America has chosen to completely ignore those astute economic principles and has taken an opposite, misguided direction in which it somehow feels that it can destroy a sizable portion of the people's purchasing power and still remain extremely profitable. Before long, you know, that might work in the short term, but before long, this disastrous irrational logic will bring down this corporate dynasty and our economy with it. When these corporate lords wipe out the economic foundation of America and the middle class, they will bring about their own demise. It's called economic death. Michael Payne. And regarding that, Prairie 2 sends in his missive for tonight. Once machine shop to the world, now leading the surge of food stamps. That's us. He writes, it's official the disparity between the wealthy in the United States and the poor has reached an all-time high. The super rich have done very well since we entered the current depression, and the middle class continues to be converted to the working poor if they have a job at all. We are coming up to winter with a higher than ever number of Americans with no utility connection. The former middle class are using up their savings, wearing out their cars if the car hasn't been repossessed. They're wearing out their clothes and neglecting medical needs, so their bodies are wearing out too. It's no surprise that consumer confidence is down again. Corporate CEO confidence is down as well, but that's just a reflection of their political talking points. They're doing very well at the top of the food chain. Marriage has hit an all-time low, and people are putting off having kids as they did in the 1930s. The number of U.S. households receiving food stamps was up by 2 million last year to 11.7 million, a more than 20% increase. This is the highest level on record, with 1 in 10 families receiving government food aid. In all, 46 states and the District of Columbia had increases in food stamps, with the largest jumps in Nevada, Arizona, Florida, and Wisconsin. Milwaukee used to be known as the machine shop to the world, but that title would now go to Shanghai as Wisconsin goes on food stamps. The percentage of old folks that are working is up again, even though the number of people forced to retire is up sharply. People who were retired have no choice but to go back to work if they can, often taking service jobs the kids used to have, further increasing youth unemployment. The stock market has been up all through September, and the crystal ball folks are predicting a new boom in the Dow, with Stock Traders Almanac predicting the index will hit 38,000 by 2025. Don't confuse that number with the title of the best-selling book, Dow 36,000. Don't recall the book? It came out just before the dot-com bubble burst. Gold jumped sharply today, going past $1,300 as the global unease grows. The embargo by China of rare earth exports continues and is approaching its first full week. Japan, who is at the center of the ban, is not getting any response from diplomatic overtures. Corporate junk bonds are selling briskly in the retail market. These are small, non-institutional investors that are chasing higher yields, and regulators are worried that this will lead to a bubble burst that these investors won't be able to handle. This will move still more middle-class people down to the level of the working poor. The median family income declined again last year, and while it still has a ways to go to get down to the official poverty rate, it continues to move relentlessly in that direction. Half of families are already way below a level that would be considered the American dream by anybody, especially if you take into account rising health care and education costs. The rich are getting richer, and everybody else is getting poorer. Less healthy, less educated, and more desperate. PrairieNumeral2.com. Interesting to me how Prairie 2's report for tonight and the piece written by Michael Payne at opednews.com dovetail so nicely. Don't you think? We'll be right back.
My sweetest friend, everyone I know goes away in the end, and you could have it all. My empire of dirt, I will let you down. I will make you great.
You don't have to. It's More Mike Malloy.
It is 25 before the hour. Now, to add another exclamation point to Michael's piece in op-ed, Prairie 2 has added one. Michael and Roswell will add another one. This is from the New York Times today. It's part of a story on cases coming before the Supreme Court coming up. The privacy case, Federal Communications Commission versus AT&T Incorporated, will consider whether a provision of the Freedom of Information Act concerning personal privacy applies to corporations. AT&T seeks to block the release of documents that it provided to the FCC, which conducted an investigation into claims of overcharges by the company in a program to provide equipment and services to schools. Kids don't vote, right? Little kids. The documents were sought under the Freedom of Information Act by a trade association representing some of AT&T's competitors. Now, you have to understand that not only are capitalist organizations hell-bent on destroying the country, they're also hell-bent on destroying each other. It's part of the game. AT&T relied on an exemption to the law for law enforcement records that could, quote, constitute an unwarranted invasion of personal privacy, end quote. The United States Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit in Philadelphia ruled for the company, relying in part on a new definition of person in the law that included corporations. Would that be the recent Supreme Court decision? That corporations have the same rights to contribute to candidates and parties and yada, yada, yada as people? Judge Michael Chigaris wrote for a unanimous three-judge panel the following, quote, corporations, like human beings, face public embarrassment, harassment, and stigma because of their involvement in law enforcement investigations. Law enforcement investigations. But wait a second, isn't the investigation against AT&T? So the three-judge panel is saying that the corporation AT&T has a right to privacy? The federal government, represented by Solicitor General Kagan, isn't she a Supreme Court justice now? Urged the Supreme Court to reject the argument that the exemption protects the so-called privacy of inanimate corporate entities. Yeah, Kagan is now Supreme Court Justice, so when this gets to the court, obviously she's going to have to recuse herself, right? What is her political persuasion? Well, the teabagger freakoids want you to believe she was a liberal. So, as Michael writes, they're now trying to establish the right to privacy, corporations are, for themselves. And yet, they don't die like the rest of us. They continue to amass wealth that they can now use without limits for political campaigns. No wonder the founders of this country got the willies thinking about how corporations fit into democracy. They fit into democracy in the same way that a Roto-Rooter machine fits into a stopped-up toilet, right? Mike from Stevens Point, Wisconsin, sent this in. Mike, I'm a podcast subscriber and really enjoy your show. I live in Stevens Point, Wisconsin, and went to Milwaukee this morning, about a 2.5-hour ride. I could not help but notice all the signs along the highways between Stevens Point and Milwaukee. They were all for the Republican candidates. I did not see one for Russ Feingold or Tom Barrett or any other Democratic candidate. Even driving around the suburbs of Milwaukee, I saw nothing but Republican signs. This scares me. I'm worried about this state. How can all these people be so stupid as to put Republicans back into power? You're right. People do have very short memories. I fear for this state as well as our country. I even saw a couple of billboards with Obama and Feingold's pictures on them being badmouthed as far as spending, taxes, and other things. This is crazy. I hope enough people in this state are smart enough to vote for Feingold, Barrett, and the other Democratic candidates. Mike from Stevens Point. You know, if we lived in sane times, if we are not being eaten alive by capitalism, I would agree with you, Mike. But, you know, I think I'm going to go back to the argument or the proposition that I had several months ago. And we mentioned it recently, I think. And that is, you know, let the teabaggers, let the Republicans have it. Not the presidency. For the next 2 years, let the Republicans control the legislative branch. Both houses. Let them. And let the American people see, for once and for all, the American people who don't vote. Because teabaggers are not anywhere near majority. They are a fringe group of toilet outhouse dwellers who make a lot of noise, and the cameras focus on them, and the Republicans party is being gutted by them, and the Democrats are running squealing into the woods. But the teabaggers are nothing but phantoms. They're here now, they'll eventually be gone. And the quickest way to get rid of these rat bastards is let them have what they're asking for, what they're demanding. Let them have the reins of legislative power. Go ahead. Let them gut Medicare, Medicaid, public services. Of course, Obama will veto all this, but let the American people see how sick these son of a bitches really are. Give them the 2 years. At that point, this country will be so close to a violent revolution against these people that one of two things will happen. Either the normal people in this country, the working class, the middle class, will have had enough of this Republican swill and these cockroaches that are the teabaggers. And that segment of the population, millions of people, will rise up. And I think they will attempt to do this nonviolently. But I don't think it'll work. Because the sanctity of the state will be foremost in the capitalists' minds. They have to have a structure within which they can dominate everybody. So the reaction to an uprising will be pretty gruesome and grim. A state of martial law declared by Obama. Yeah, what choice is he going to have? And then we'll find out, like the Chinese in Tiananmen Square found out, if the American soldier will fire on the American citizen. Now, that's one scenario. The other scenario is that the American people will have had so much in the next 2 years of these filthy bastards, these right-wingers, these teabaggers, these Republicans, these phony conservatives, that they will again rise up. But this time, to vote them out of office with such overwhelming majorities that the Republican Party will become what it is supposed to be, something dumped on the junk heap of history and left to rot. And then the next step, of course, will be the establishment of an economic system that is not predatory and destructive like American capitalism. I favor a mixed economy. I think a lot of people do at this point. Certain key industries will be public, completely public, socialized. Certain private industries will be allowed to flourish as long as they play by the rules. We need to have a complete collapse, is what I'm trying to say. And it's going to be painful, and it's going to be awful. There's going to be a lot of people who are going to suffer. A lot of us are going to be without work. A lot of us are going to be without medical care. A lot of us are going to die. A lot of our children are going to get sick, and they're going to die. It's going to be awful. But do you see an alternative? Do you think the ballot box is still a workable method to stop this insanity by these right-wingers, by the capitalists, who are determined, just like the piece at Op-Ed News, determined to return this country to feudalism? Do you see an alternative? Don't forget, where is it? I've got it over here. There are four boxes to be used in the defense of liberty. Soap, ballot, jury, ammo. Used in that order. So, how close are we? I don't know. I thought the country would convulse during the reign of the pig Dick Cheney and his puppet George W. Bush, but it didn't happen, and I'm not sure why. I guess because we still had the illusion of, if not prosperity, certainly survivability. But that illusion is disappearing. So what's going to happen next? Is it going to be the ballot box or the ammo box? I wonder. People are gonna rise up and take what's there.
Get your news unfiltered, only with Mike Malloy.
It's 10 before the hour. Coming up next hour, we have a report from Vanity Fair about Sarah Palin's really a part of God's plan. God's plan to completely burn everything on this planet and purify it and carry the raptured into heaven. Sarah Palin apparently is the latest incarnation of the biblical figure Esther. And also next hour, what else we got here? That should be enough, right? But, oh my God. Who do you suppose is the most knowledgeable about religion? Now, if you watched Overman's program tonight, you already know the answer to that. You know, I take great pains to research topics for this program, and then Keith Overman steals them. And because he makes millions and has a huge budget, he can do it much better than we, but we still go ahead and do it anyway. Hamid Karzai has named, he's our puppet in Afghanistan, with Bob Woodward's new book, Obama's Wars, a lot of conversation right now about the war in Afghanistan, the occupation, the murder, the killing that's going on, and how, you know, frankly, how futile it is. And apparently Obama felt the same way, but his generals his war makers, his Secretary of State, his Secretary of Defense, these neocon right-wingers who are hell-bent on continuing the war because it's very profitable. We all know that. There's all this conflict going on within the White House. In the meantime, you know, let me back up a little bit. Petraeus, our proconsul in Afghanistan, now that McChrystal was fired, Petraeus and a bunch of Mike Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Hillary Clinton, a psychopathic Secretary of State, all these people are convinced that we're going to be there a long, long time fighting the Taliban. That's who we're fighting. We're not fighting Al-Qaeda anymore. There is no Al-Qaeda there. We're fighting the Taliban so that we can steal anything that is not we, not you and me, but capitalist America can steal anything that's not nailed down or planted. And the stuff that is nailed down and planted will be uprooted and unnailed. We want the rare earth minerals that are there. We want the $1 trillion worth of minerals that exist in that country. Right below the surface, apparently. You don't even have to dig in Afghanistan, right? There's gas, there's oil, there's this, there's that. Okay. Well, because of that, we're going to be there for a long, long time, according to the capitalist operatives, who most of which Obama's cabinet is comprised of. That's how it sounds. But in the middle of all this, President Hamid Karzai today named a 70-member peace council to meet with the Taliban. Karzai named at least 8 women, which means that this peace council is going to fail. The Taliban will not talk to women. The Taliban is only interested in having sex with women as long as they're covered up properly or beating them. To sit down with 8 women to talk about preserving women's rights in this phony constitution that Afghanistan has is insane. Insane. The government, Karzai, defended the nominations of these 8 women, saying the council to negotiate with the Taliban needed a broad range of people. But anyway, the important thing here is that Hamid Karzai understands that eventually the Americans are going to leave or have him killed. Because all Karzai has to do is take a look at other puppets that we have installed around the globe, Western Hemisphere, Eastern Hemisphere, Northern Hemisphere, Southern Hemisphere. It makes no difference. And Karzai, although he's a con artist and a thief and a grifter of the highest order, he's not a fool. He doesn't want to have an accident in some canyon in Afghanistan. So he's going to make a deal with the people who are not leaving. The Taliban. Well, our military leader, General David Petraeus, finds all this very interesting and indicated support for this process yesterday. Because Petraeus knows it's not going to work. Or at least he thinks it's not going to work. The joke will be, of course, if Hamid Karzai can work a deal with the Taliban. I say joke because just before a document like that would be signed, Hamid Karzai would have an accident. His plane would crash. Who do we do that to? That was Omar Torrijos, wasn't it? In Panama. He was getting a little out of control of the CIA, so his plane took off and plunk, crashed. And we put in Noriega. Until he got a little unruly and then invade his country and put him in prison in Florida. You know, Hamid Karzai knows this. He knows how capitalist America works. As long as Hamid Karzai was willing to go along with the charade that the American troops were there to fight for freedom and democracy and establish a government like we did in Iraq, Hamid Karzai was safe. But once Hamid Karzai came to the realization that eventually either the American troops would leave or he would have an accident and die or both, once he realized that, Hamid Karzai said, I better make a deal with the Taliban. And That's what's going on in Afghanistan. Isn't this fun? All right, the really good part of the program is coming up because we're going to be talking about Sarah Palin and her rendezvous with destiny in the persona of the famous Jewish savior woman, Esther. Stick around. I'm Mike Malloy. Still here? Oh my God. Gluttons for punishment, huh? How about your right wing ghouls who lurk around the edge of the radio band. What's that Malloy talking about? Did you hear what he said about Dick Cheney? Hey, as I mentioned, I have been mentioning, especially last night, I brought it up again, so many Republicans who are running from for office, whether they are mainstream Republicans, if such a thing exists anymore, which I doubt, or the psycho fringe of the Republican Party, which has become its base, and that would be the teabag maniacs. Regardless of where these candidates fit on the Republican Party spectrum, they are all using Jesus or God as a club to beat people into submission. Have you noticed that? Oh, Lord have mercy, some of the things these people are doing. You know, this is where, from my standpoint of being a full-blown, total, complete atheist, I have the luxury or the freedom of saying, were there a God, I would assume that it would reach down and pinch these thugs' heads off and throw them into hell where they would be used as soccer balls. But since religious mythology is just that, to the chagrin of a lot of us who would like to see divine retribution, it just never happens. It just doesn't happen. But these candidates, these Republican fundamentalist crazy people, and of course the template is Sarah Palin, and I get to her in a second. Oh, my God. She thinks she's Esther out of the Bible, right? I know a lot of you true believers don't have a clue of who Esther was or what her function was in the Hebrew Bible, but that's okay. I'm going to get to that in a second, too. Religious people, it's always been my contention that fervent believers, people who are fundamentalists, they use their religion as a cover for their horrendous and sad insecurity. Or anxiety, primarily about their own mortality, their own death that looms in front of everybody. Once you become cognizant that you are limited in the amount of time you're going to have to be conscious, not amount of time on this planet, but the amount of time you're going to have to be conscious, all sorts of things come into play. If you're a psychopath like Dick Cheney, before his heart turns into this endless flow of sound, if you're a psychopath like Dick Cheney, you try to destroy as many other lives as you possibly can before your consciousness ends. If you're a maniac like Hitler or Stalin, you do the same thing. Mao, whoever it is. People who commit mass murder are usually firm believers. Now, a lot of people say, well, Malloy, Stalin was an atheist. No, he wasn't. He was an ardent Orthodox Christian. He adopted atheism as a means of setting himself apart so that he could commit the murders that he committed. What about Mao Zedong? He wasn't a religious man. I'll tell you what, you go back and read, you people who say that have never read a biography, ever, of Mao. So go read one and then come back later. It's like Mark Ahana said to me when the time came to debate the primacy of the Jews or the Palestinian Arabs where it concerned Israel. And Kahana said to me, what's your scholarship? I'm not going to talk to you unless I'm convinced you know what you're talking about. Well, I would say the same to people who want to argue about this stuff. You tell me, send me an email, tell me what your scholarship is, and maybe I'll consider what you have to say. Because religion destroys logic. It destroys the ability to think, the ability to use rational thought, the ability to look at a situation and say, okay, this action has consequences that are final. And there is no redemption later on. There is no moment on the cross when the avatar of some religion turns to me and says, you know, this day you will be with my Father in heaven, no matter what you did. You know, that kind of mythology doesn't exist any more than Zeus hurling a thunderbolt from Mount Olympus and wiping out somebody that really, really, really pisses Zeus off. It's all, it's part of human history, religion is. I'm not saying that religion is not a very interesting subject to study, but for me, to study it from its negative impact on the human species. As far as I'm concerned, religion has never, ever, under any circumstances, had a standalone positive impact on human beings. A lot of people say, well, yeah, people, my people believed in religion, did all this good. Religion was not a necessary condition from which to do good. That's just the way it was presented. Now, the reason I'm bringing this up this hour, a Pew study released today. Was it today? Yeah, it was earlier today. It was a study released by the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life. And the takeaway from this report is that atheists and agnostics are the most knowledgeable about religion. Tend to be people who grew up in religious surroundings or religious traditions, and at some point in their lives consciously gave it up. That would be my definition. That would be my journey from knowing about as much about religion as a kid can learn, short of being a member of a cult like Mormonism or Catholicism. I was brought up in the cult of fundamentalist Christianity. And, you know, not to the point where it influenced everything, because it was just my grandmother who practiced that, and I only spent summers with her. So, but there was a lot of the fundamentalist aspect of religion that was presented to me as being irrefutable truth. So atheists, people who, for the most part, were exposed to religion but decided to give it up, atheists were more likely to answer the survey's questions correctly. Next were Jews and Mormons. They ranked just below atheists in the survey's measurement of religious knowledge, so close, in fact, that they appeared to be almost statistically tied. Atheists, Jews, and Mormons, insofar as a working knowledge or understanding of religion, of various religions, where it concerned, where it was presented in the survey. And the answer to the question, why would an atheist know more about religion than a Christian, is because we grew up in the religious tradition, and after, in most cases, after a lot of reflection, a lot of study, which I think people who select atheism or agnosticism as an understanding, I think you come to that, as the survey indicated, through a lot of study, personal study. I'm not talking about necessarily university study or focus study with someone leading the way, but just your own curiosity. So the survey said that atheists are people who thought a lot about religion. Atheists are not indifferent about religion. They care about it. Don't misunderstand the use of the word care there, but I agree with that. Atheists also tend to be relatively well-educated, and agnostics. And the survey found, and I don't think it's surprising, that the most knowledgeable people were also the best educated. However, it said the atheists and agnostics also outperformed believers who had similar levels of education. So education is not necessarily the standard by which this belief in supernatural stuff can be judged. The groups at the top of this list, atheists, agnostics, and then came Jews and Mormons, and then working down, white evangelical Protestants, and then white Catholics, and then white mainline Protestants, and then people who were unaffiliated with any faith, but were not atheistic or agnostic. You know, they just didn't have one. Then came black Protestants, and at the bottom, Latino Catholics. Muslims, Hindus, and Buddhists were included in the survey, but their numbers, according to the Pew Center, were too small to be broken out as statistically significant groups. Stephen Prothero, who's a professor of religion at Boston University, said, "I think in general what the survey confirms is that we know almost nothing about our own religions and even less about the religions of other people." Now, of course, this is, as far as I'm concerned, this is key to the things we've been talking about. Since religion has been dragged into the political arena by, for the most part, Christian fundamentalists in this country, whether they're Catholic or Protestant, is immaterial. It's been dragged and dragged and dragged until it reminds me kind of the way Jesus was depicted by Mel Gibson in what was the movie where Christ was beaten and flayed, and what was that movie? Remember that? Yeah, the Mel Gibson movie. I can't think of the title either. But while we didn't see the movie, we saw some of the scenes of that particular depiction of Jesus, bloodied and beaten and tortured. And you know, a lot of Protestants, a lot of evangelicals and fundamentalists took their kids to see that. It should have been rated X. It was strictly religio-violent porn. It was pornography of the worst sort. You know, these same parents who took their kids to see that would scream bloody murder if their kids had a video of a couple having sexual intercourse. But show pictures of this man being beaten until his skin was hanging in strips, blood all over the place, as Mel Gibson, another Opus Dei Catholic, as that was presented, that kind of depiction of horrific violence is okay. But let a kid be looking at a video of sexual intercourse, the parents will immediately call up a psychologist. Oh, my God, my kid. More on this when we come back. And it is not I that keeps injecting this discussion into the political forum. Not in the least. We'll be right back.
With the truth. It's more Mike Malloy.
It is 25 before the hour. And once again, we are talking about religion on this program. I'm sorry. I know to a lot of people it's a waste of time. A lot of people who have evolved beyond, mentally evolved beyond the need to think in terms of supernatural phenomena that are based strictly on a person's fear of death and dying, which I truly believe is the foundational basis for religion, for a belief in some supernatural existence out there in heaven, you know, up in the sky or wherever. Anyway, the study by the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life showed that atheists and agnostics are far more knowledgeable about all religion than the adherents to those specific religions. In second place are Jews and Mormons, who also have a considerable amount of knowledge. Interesting about the Mormons, who are considered not considered Christians by many Christian fundamentalists. The Mormons are considered to be some, I don't know, members of a cult, which is how I see them. But they showed greater knowledge of the Bible than evangelical Christians. And you know, it goes on and on. The Pew survey was not without its bright spots for the devout, though. According to LA Times, 8 in 10 people on the survey knew that Mother Teresa was Catholic. Maybe the term mother gave him a clue. 7 in 10 knew that, according to the Bible, Moses led the Exodus from Egypt. And also 7 in 10 knew that Jesus was born in Bethlehem. Woo! Okay, way to go, Christians. But the part of this that's really scary is that 20% did not know that Mother Teresa was Catholic. 30% did not know about Moses and Exodus, and 30% did not know that their own Savior was born in Bethlehem. It's crazy, crazy. The question that elicited the most correct responses on the survey concerned whether public school teachers are allowed to lead their classes in prayer. 89% of the respondents correctly said no. However, two-thirds also said that such teachers are not permitted to read from the Bible as an example of literature, something that the law clearly allows. But, oh well. Now, to me, the really scary part of all this, the survey threw in, for comparison purposes, some questions about general knowledge. You know, they just dropped the questions in. If you've ever taken an intelligence test or a test of general knowledge or specific knowledge, you know that certain questions will pop up, and you sit there as you're answering the questions going, what the hell is this doing in here? This doesn't relate to anything. Well, they're there for a specific reason. And there were a couple of questions about general knowledge that were scattered throughout the survey, and they yielded the scariest findings, at least to me. Only 4% of Americans... no, wait a second. Have I got this right? Yeah. 94%? It's hard to read this. Of Americans believe that Stephen King, not Herman Melville, wrote Moby Dick. And if you ask people who have read Moby Dick if it is a religious allegory, a lot of them will tell you yes. Or an allegory regarding anything. Madness, greed, fury. When in fact it probably had more to do with whale oil than anything else. So anyway, studying other religions. What I've found, so many fundamentalists just refuse to study other people's religions. And they do so because, well, look at the craziness among the Christian fundamentalists now about Islam in this country, which is taking this country right up to a very dangerous edge of a cliff. The hatred that the Christian fundamentalists are engendering where it concerns Islam, and not just the Christian fundamentalists. All these slimy bastards that infest the airwaves are doing the same thing. You think about the statements of Ann Coulter over the years about, you know, invade all the Muslim lands, kill their leaders, and convert them to Christianity. I mean, can you imagine if somebody said that about invade the United States, kill all their leaders, and convert them to Judaism or Islam or something? There are so many people that have the public, they have prominence in the public forum, like Beck or like Coulter or like some of these insane preachers who usually wind up, the ones that are very ardently anti-gay, usually wind up having a couple, three boyfriends stashed someplace. So, but the ugliness that is put out there by the Christians against Islam right now, Muslims are the new Jews, right? Historically, the Christians have railed against the Jews. Well, all of a sudden, can't do that anymore because of our support for Israel, and it's very important to stay close to the Jews because, you know, Jesus will only come back when he's satisfied that enough people have been slaughtered and the Jews are in control of his birthplace or something like that. It's just madness. Every bit of it is insane. It is all insane. But what happens if you do not educate yourself about other people's religions? You involve yourself in demonizing other people's religions until eventually there is violence. The whole damn enterprise ought to be declared null and void and let people get on with the idea of living without superstitious nonsense. And I don't care if that nonsense comes from Deepak Chopra or some freak who stands in a church in the North Georgia mountains with a bag of snakes every Wednesday night. It's all madness. And I'm open for you to refute that, of course. Not on the air. Send me an email. Bleh. It's just... Now, Sarah Palin has often suggested that she believes her rise to power is divinely ordained. Are you aware of that? An email obtained by Vanity Fair suggests that not just the hoe from Wasilla, but others see Sarah Palin as a figure of biblical importance. Michael Gross, writing at Vanity Fair, brings all this out. Palin is the only contemporary American politician whose admirers openly describe her as a modern-day version of a biblical character. Huh? And on the main pro-Palin blog, Conservatives for Palin, many postings contemplate Palin's resemblance to Queen Esther. Yeah, the hero of a very short book in the Hebrew Bible. And Palin herself encourages the analogy. She does. This past April, for instance, she told a Christian group in Louisville, Kentucky, that she often reads the book of Esther to her daughter Piper at bedtime. Sarah seems to have forgotten the idea that she might be a... Or she got the idea that she might be a new Esther shortly after being elected governor in 2006. What she did, she asked one of her former pastors, one of those ones that drive out the haints and the spooks and the ghosts. She asked one of her former pastors for an example of biblical leadership that she could fashion herself after. She could become, you know, oh, who should I be? My immediate thought was Judas. But quoting scripture, the pastor told Palin that she, like Esther, quote, had come to the kingdom for such a time. Time is this, end quote. Oh, my God. Now, that reference requires a little bit of unpacking. Due to her extraordinary beauty, the biblical Esther, a Jew, was taken as the wife of a Persian king, Ahasuerus. When an advisor named Haman persuaded Ahasuerus to proclaim that all Jews in his kingdom should be killed, I mean, it just never stops, does it, my Jewish brethren? Oh, my God. Esther's Jewish cousin, Mordecai, who raised her after she was orphaned, told her that she had to persuade the king to spare her people. And Mordecai said, if you remain silent this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place, but you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to royal position for such a time as this. Now, somehow, these Christian fundamentalist crazy people think that Sarah Palin has come to rescue, not just, well, the new Jew. The new Jew is not the Muslim, like I said a moment ago. The new Jew is the offended Christian fundamentalists who are being totally dominated, beaten, kicked, and screamed at by the Muslim in the White House. Do you get all this, right? You get this, right? Of course you do. You get this. So the biblical inference, or the inference that Sarah Palin is this biblical reincarnation. She is Esther. I have come to protect my people. I have come to stop the murder, the slaughter of my people by the other in the White House. You know, the dark-skinned guy. No, not John Boehner. The other one. These people are mad. Now, There's a little bit more here. There's an email that I want to share with you that came from a religious crazy person and was delivered to Sarah Palin right before she had her first debate with Joe Biden. And you got to hear this. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. Sarah Palin, who considers herself, as do some of her followers, to be pretty much a reincarnation of the biblical character Esther, who was charged with saving the Jews from the terrible Persian king, who eventually, the Persians became Muslims, right? You get it? An email obtained by Vanity Fair appears in full here. I'm going to read it to you. Offers the clearest evidence yet how seriously Palin and her advisors take her analogy of being a modern Esther. The email is written by Lou Engel, a right-wing pastor and political activist who founded a movement known as The Call, which has coordinated widespread prayer and fasting to protest health care reform. Jesus, God, and same-sex marriage. Of the latter, same-sex marriage, Reverend Engel has said, quote, what happened to California, that would be, the legalization of gay marriage. What happened to California will release a spirit that is more demonic than Islam. Right? A spirit of lawlessness and anarchy. And a sexual insanity will be unleashed into the earth. End quote. If that's not someone who is clinically sick, then you tell me, like Dick Cheney. I mean, you tell me, right? Engel's email was sent to Palin as a last-minute exhortation just before she took the stage for her debate against Biden in 2008. It's an extraordinary document referring to legalized abortion as a Holocaust and casting Reverend Engel in the role of Mordecai to Palin's Esther. The message was handed to Palin's advisors with a gravity that suggests it was a message they knew Palin would want to see. Here it is. Dear Sarah, many thousands are fasting and praying for you. I know you've heard it, but I believe this is an Esther moment in your life. Esther hid her identity until Mordecai challenged her to risk everything for such a time as this. Your identity as Sarah Barracuda is deliberate. Esther removed corruption from the Persian government, and Haman fell. She didn't have experience. She had grace and favor. Sarah, don't hide your identity tonight. There will be a question given to you that you don't know, and I have been weeping over you. I believe the Lord would have you be real if they ask you a question that you don't know. Don't be ashamed to say, I don't have the experience of 30 years of politics like Senator Biden, but what I do have is character, truth, and integrity, and I haven't been seduced by 30 years of political and moral compromise like these men in D.C. I believe America is not looking for more knowledge. They're looking for more character and more truth, and that is who I am. I refuse the politics of neutrality. I will stand for the family. I will stand on foundations of truth, and this nation will be better for it. Say that, Sarah. I'm sure you're doing this, but take a moment to still yourself right now before the Lord. The Lord is a shield about you. To those who have no strength, the Lord will show himself powerful. Sarah, I could be wrong, but I've been praying for 5 years for an Esther with dreams of my being a Mordecai to that Esther. I believe you're the one. And I think you're even wearing a life band. What? Tonight, don't be ashamed to plead for the life of the unborn and all the wounded women who have gone through this Holocaust. You can throw this email away, but I have 50 young people fasting and praying day and night who are shouting tonight, grace, grace to you, hallelujah, amen and amen and amen, we love you. Lou Engel. Just when you think the Bible thumpers can't get any crazier, an email like this comes up. Right? Thanks to Dot in Seattle who sent this to me. Yeah, isn't that the truth? I have been praying for an Esther so that I can be Mordecai. You know, I've been praying for a Gretel so I can be Hansel. I've been praying for a Cinderella so I can be Prince Charming. It's all about me, Sarah. But you go ahead. I need my Esther. Go ahead. Step out there, baby. Come on. Give me hell, Esther or Sarah or somebody. Sarah Barracuda. You're referred to as Sarah Barracuda. Your identity is Sarah Barracuda. What was Esther? Esther the tester? Esther the jester? Sarah Barracuda? I mean, if this is not madness, if this is not insanity, and then you look at that Pew survey about, this is my interpretation, how utterly and absolutely ignorant and stupid these religious bigots really are. Lou Engel. Sarah, be my Esther. We'll kill your husband because I know he'll get in the way. I will be Mordecai, your cousin. And it's okay if cousins do it. You know, what the heck? What are you? Well, we'll be second cousins. How's that? I have the hots for you, Sarah. I love you. Okay, not love. I want you. Be my Esther. I have 30 young people chained to the floor, praying and fasting. So anyway, go ahead, vote Republican this year. I've come to the conclusion once again, let's just get it over with. Put these religious, political, insane people in office. We have 2 years. Put them in. At the end of 2 years, the American people will realize what they have done. And then never again will the American people sit back on their collective asses and say, well, the political system is so corrupt, I don't have anything to do with it. The American people will then devise an alternative to the corrupt political system and reclaim our country. But in order for people to realize how sick and degenerate these right-wing bastards really are, let them have the power. But remember, 2 years, because if it goes longer than 2 years, we'll have to take the power back by the box that is not the ballot box. I'll see you tomorrow night. Take care. Keep it lit. Hallelujah and hallelujah. I'm Mike Malloy.